Today we have Guilherme Frenzman from Nordita, and he will tell us about alpha prime cosmological tail, string cosmology backgrounds from classical string geometry. And Guilherme is fine with questions during the talk, so you can interrupt him anytime. Just raise your hand on Zoom. And with this, Guilherme can start.
Okay, thanks for the invitation. It's nice to be back at Perimeter to give a talk again, even if it's online. It's also a privilege to be talking about these four papers that are the main topic of the talk. As you can see, they are all from around more or less 2 years ago. So at the same time, it's a privilege to be going back to that to give a talk about that, but also a bit frightening because I have moved on from those works. So hopefully I'm going to be able to capture the picture precisely as much as possible. This is going to also be a sort of a tale in the sense that we're going to start from very fundamental principles all the way to trying to come up with a model for the early universe. So I'm going to try to be as pedagogical as possible, but please let me know if you have any questions during the talk. Okay, so so that we don't forget that we are physicists in the end, let me start with observations. To some extent, this is the main point that we want to explain what is the CMB, which is this black body radiation that we observe across the sky with a temperature roughly of 2.7 Kelvin nowadays, and fluctuations between hot and cold spots that are of order 10 to the minus 5 the temperature. And so this is the, as probably most of you know, this is a snapshot of the very early universe. And whatever cosmological model that we want to come up with should be able to account for the structure that we observe in this map. And quite surprisingly, we do have a standard cosmological model, which is called the Lambda CDM model, Lambda accounting for dark energy and CDM for cold dark matter. And this model is very successful. In fact, we have only six different parameters. And with that, we can explain pretty much all the current cosmological data that we have available. And two of those parameters are actually more directly connected to the CMB map. They model or they appear in the power spectrum associated with the CMB map. Here you can show in terms of the amplitude of the power spectrum defining Fourier space, and also as this exponent that tells us what's the scale dependence of the power spectrum in this map. This NS is called the spectral index. And we know that in order to fit the CMB map, the Planck collaboration has measured or has found the best fit for those parameters. And the amplitude square, of course, is of order 10 to the minus 9 to account for those small fluctuations. While the exponent of momentum dependence here is almost zero. In fact, the spectral index is slightly smaller than 1. Which means that the modes which are in the infrared have more power actually than the ones in the ultraviolet. But the fact that it's almost zero, if it was zero, it'd be what we call scale invariant. And somehow whatever model that we come up with for the early universe should be able to explain why we do observe this scale invariance of the power spectrum. And so the big question here, when you look back to that map and in light of the model that we have and the parameters that we have introduced, is how can we recover this almost k-invariant thermalized sort of spectrum? Because otherwise it could be puzzling and it could maybe hint to some sort of acausal physics, given that this map is spread across the sky. It turns out, and perhaps people are not so familiar with that, that even in the 70s, Peebles and Yu in the States, and actually also Zeldovich and Suniaev in the Soviet Union, they had come up with the minimum condition to explain or to recover an almost k-invariant power spectrum. And you need two ingredients. So one of them was that you should be able to produce standing waves, which means that you have constant amplitude on super Hubble scales, meaning here super Hubble, you mean you take the Hubble parameter and take it to the minus one power. That gives you some physical rays associated with the Hubble scale. And so the waves that are stretching beyond the Hubble radius, they should become they should have some kind of like constant amplitude. And this should happen before the CMB was emitted. So in fact, if you would open Suniaev and Zeldovich papers in the 70s, you can actually see pictures like that we usually attribute or we see when we are looking at papers on inflation, explaining how come you can actually produce this k-invariant power spectrum. And so not surprisingly, perhaps 10 years later, inflation showed up. And inflation was the first model that realized or introduced a natural way to recover those two ingredients, having this standing waves with constant amplitude in super Hubbard scales before the CMB was emitted. And as we probably know, the inflation basically accounts for this period in the very early universe in which you have this phase of quasi de Sitter expansion. And in fact, it was quite predictive at the time. It accounted for an almost k-invariant power spectrum. And in general, most of the inflationary models, they do come up with a spectral index that gives you some sort of a latitude for the power spectrum. Okay, I think maybe Lee has a question.
Yes, I don't think that that's what motivated Alan Guth and others at the time. At the time, people assumed that many different mechanisms would produce a scale and drain spectrum. Mm-hmm. And what was special about inflation was that it explained the monopole problem.
Absolutely.
And other problems of remnants. I don't think that at the time there was much discussion at all about explaining the scale and drain spectrum because there were many different ways. It wasn't such a unusual, it wasn't seen in need of explanation.
Absolutely. In fact, we only know about the red tilt much later with the measurements from the WMAP, for instance. So this is not really meant to be a chronological historical account of what happened. It's more a story in hindsight of what actually happened, knowing now that inflation does have this prediction for the red tilt of scalar perturbations.
But then, of course, we have to remember that it doesn't.
Yeah. So I'm introducing inflation to criticize it. So, okay. But yeah. So going ahead, just to show what's a typical picture that we have when you think about inflation. When inflationary period starts, here's the solid blue line is the Hubble radius. When inflation starts, it becomes constant, as you can see right here. And when it ends, it grows linearly on time with the depending on the kind of matter content you have, the angle here of this curve is going to be different. But then what happens is that the modes that were originally inside, or they are within the Hubble radius, they grow exponentially, they cross the Hubble radius and they become super Hubble, and later on they re-enter the region of the Hubble radius. And while they are super Hubble, they do have this constant amplitude. So you have the necessary ingredients that Peebles and you already had investigated 10 years prior to inflation. Okay, so that's more or less the picture that happens for inflation. Of course, just one more detail, as you probably know, the horizon, meanwhile, gets stretched exponentially, as you can see here. So everything happens in a causal way, and that's why inflation also can explain away the problems that we have at the background level, such as the flattens problem or the horizon problem, also known as the size of the universe problem. But there are problems, as you probably know. We still don't have a proper account for what would be the inflaton, which is this non-fundamental scalar field that could give rise to inflation. In fact, inflation seems to lead also to some sort of eternal inflation and multiverse scenario that people may or may not like it, depending on from which camp you're approaching this issue. There is something called the Trans-Plancken problem. As you can imagine, going back to the picture we had before, some modes could actually start off as small as the Planck length, and then it's unclear that you can still rely on GR and GR perturbation theory to tackle those evolution of those modes. And finally, even if you are comfortable with all those three different problems, inflation cannot get rid of the initial singularity problem. And this is the main focus of my talk and of the model that I'm going to be discussing. How can we come up with a way of maybe having a non-singular early universe cosmological model? And of course, we don't like inflation sometimes in economy as well. So perhaps that's very telling. Jokes apart, There are alternatives, as Lee already mentioned. Some of them came also from the string context point of view. This is the plot that you expect to have for the early universe. If you're coming from a string guess point of view, this is a model that was developed by Robert Brandenberger and Kuhn Waffe in the late 80s. And here you have a kind of like different picture of the early universe. You see here that the Hubble radius starts off infinitely and then decays considerably and then grows again when you reach again the standard cosmological evolution. But then you see that the modes here, because the Hubble radius is infinity, it means that the Hubble parameter is virtually zero. So you are in a static phase. So the modes are not evolving. Naturally, when the Hubble parameter starts growing, then the modes leave the Hubble radius and they become super Hubble. And here, as long as you have some sort of holographic scaling that would have to be justified coming from a string theory perspective, then you can still, even though you have this different background evolution, recover a power spectrum which is also a scale invariant. Nowadays, to detach this whole picture from only the context of string gas cosmology, this has been coined as the emergent scenario. So people try to realize this particular evolution also in other contexts that go beyond string theory.
Okay. Sorry, just one question. So this is essentially the emergent universe scenario that I think was proposed at some point by George Ellis, right? And in this case, so I think that model would already be able to explain the flatness and the homogeneity of space-time at large distances. And so I was wondering why you also need the holographic scaling, or if you wrote that only because it comes from a specific string models like string gas cosmology.
I mean, the whole point is that what happens to at the end of this whole process to have a scale invariant power spectrum is that not only you have to rely on initial conditions for this power spectrum at the beginning of these dynamics, but also you have to rely on the dynamics itself. And so you have to combine the initial conditions plus the dynamics so that at the end you have a power spectrum which it looks like scale invariant. Here, because now we have changed the background dynamics, you cannot rely anymore with like the normal bunch of Davis vacuum that you have as initial condition for inflation. If you had that, then at the end of this evolution, you don't have a power spectrum, which is scale invariant. And so what the common law in string gas cosmology is that the initial conditions, they come from thermal fluctuations of the strings. And then you can compute the initial power spectrum associated with this thermal state by using holographic scaling. I'm not sure if this answered your questions, but that's the way I see it.
Okay, maybe I will have a look at it because I thought that the emergent universe scenario, like from the Einstein universe, it is in a sense similar to bouncing cosmology. It's just the, if I remember correctly, the second derivative, the scalar, scale factor that is different. And in a bouncing cosmology or emergent universe scenario that I know, they were alternatives to inflation that are able to solve all the related problems. Probably there is something more that one has to put in as ingredients.
Now, there is a paper by also Roberts and David Wands. I think this is like early 90s, where they show what you're describing, that in fact, you can have a quasi-de-Sitter phase or a bouncing, a matter bounce, that both lead to a power spectrum, which is almost scale invariant. The problem with the bounce is that you go through this phase, which you don't have any control of what's happening in your theory. So you have to somehow postulate that the physics is well behaved so that you can cross across the bounds with your fluctuations. But perhaps we can come back to that.
Yes, I remember that. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so we do have alternatives, as I just mentioned. So the summary so far is that to some extent, the cosmological model it still remains incomplete insofar as that we still have initial singularity to tackle. Now, we do believe that singularities are in general classical. And so one could expect that having a proper quantum gravity theory should be able to allow you to get rid of those singularities, right? And one of them is string theory. So it's going to be the focus of this talk. It's worth mentioning that before we try to simply go beyond inflation as a framework, of course, one could expect maybe to embed inflation within string theory. And perhaps you are aware of that there is a very, very extensive debate if it's possible or not to have an inflationary phase coming from string theory or the sitter in general. So some people are going to say that there are no convincing embedding of inflation string theory. The highlight of the discussion came to be also a few years ago through the Swampland conjectures. And there is also the TCC, the Transplanting Censorship Conjecture, that would argue against that. So our approach here is going to say like, okay, so perhaps we can try to do something else within the realm of string theory. And a good motivation to do that is that string theory goes much beyond the typical, you know, scalar field, quantum field theory that we have available that has motivated inflation. Because in string theory, you not only have new degrees of freedom, but you also have new symmetries and dualities. So maybe we can try to exploit that and see what comes as a feasible early universe model. So these are the first part of the talk. I'm happy to answer more questions if you have any. Otherwise, I will keep going. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of theory do you think, in terms of general principles, what are you really looking for? You say you're looking for a quantum theory of gravity that explains why there is the spectrum that we see, which is a nearly scalar invariant, but what's your story? How do you expect? Why do you expect that this should be possible at all?
Why do you expect should be what? Sorry.
Why should it be possible at all to start? Or why isn't it easy?
Right. So my approach here is going to be very, very pragmatical. I guess my approach is like, if I am a cosmologist trying to understand what happened during the early universe, and someone presents me a possible candidate for quantum gravity, let's say string theory, I will try to engineer that so that I can recover the needed ingredients to explain the CMB map. So it's going to be very pragmatical. I won't be approaching this from a more foundational point of view, trying to expect to cook up some quantum gravity theory that would indeed explain those features.
So maybe
in another way I could phrase it would be the following. It's very hard to bring string theory to the observational realm. And if we can try to do something here that maybe it would forbid us of approaching even talking about the early universe physics that we know has to be there in order to give rise to the CMB, I'm happy, because then it's a way of maybe trying to create some bounds or some constraints on the theory coming from the more phenomenological point of view. It is a stretch though, and we're gonna see some of the shortcomings of this stretch.
Yes, so maybe at the end we could come back and discuss whether there are other ways to start this.
Absolutely, I'm very happy to tackle this starting point. But this is going to be my starting point for this talk. Okay, so let's start now the second part of the talk. As I just said, we're going to be relying on string theory as our candidate for theory of quantum gravity. Of course, this is very biased. There are many other approaches to talk about quantum gravity. But I'm going to take this very pragmatical stance for this talk. Now, the thing about string theory is that the perturbative structure of the theory is well known. There are two different parameters that you can expand the theory in. So the first one is the string coupling, this GS over here. And this is a QFT-ish kind of expansion. It's the same sort of thing that we do when you do loop calculations in QFT, and you choose more and more vertices as you keep increasing the order of calculations of your Feynman diagrams. But string theory also comes with another kind of perturbative structure, which is an expansion on this alpha prime, the square root of alpha prime, which is a string length. And this is a purely stringish kind of perturbative structure of the theory. And it has to do with the fact intuitively that when you zoom out away from the strings, they will look more and more like point particles. So there is some natural limit that you should expect to recover what we understand the low energy effective theories. And those are usually supergravities or even the GR limits in string theory. Of course, it's going to be valid only for a small curvature. So this is when this is the formal sense in which you're zooming away from the strings. The issue with that is that the singularities that we are worried with, they actually happen when the curvature is usually going towards infinity. So you can imagine that all those low energy EFTs coming from string theory, they are actually not really valid unless you are able to introduce string corrections, classical string corrections, due to the fact that you have those these perturbations on the side of the string. And moreover, you need to introduce all of them, because when you approach then this regime, there is no sense anymore that you can rely on the perturbative structure of the theory. You need to include all the corrections, infinity tower of prime corrections, as they are usually known by. And this is what we're going to be discussing, at least for very specific cosmological backgrounds. Okay, so we can see where the whole story started. And the story for the formalism that we're going to be discussing here spans more or less 30 years or so. And it starts back in the early 90s when people realized that when you take the bosonic supergravity action, for which you have the metric, you have a dilaton field, a scalar field, and you also have a two-form field, the B field, and you impose a cosmological ansatz, people realized back then that you have some global ODD symmetry, which generalized some scale-factor duality. So scale-factor duality was a duality that people realized that you could take the radius of your universe and send to its reciprocal, and the theory was the same. But now with also the metric and the two-form field and the dilaton, you could actually combine those fields in different variables. And then you'd see that there is another symmetry, this global symmetry contained in the theory. Not long after, a year after, people took that particular action and they written it in a covariant way. So this is an ODD covariant string cosmology. This was the name of the paper in the early 90s. And of course, this was at the time only the lowest order in alpha prime. So we're going to be reviewing this theory later on. Which what was also realized in the same year by Sen was that this ODD symmetry was actually present to all orders in alpha prime, as long as you remain the fields to be spatially independent. Of course, they didn't have the full theory order by order in alpha prime. So this was actually a result that came from string field theory, where they could actually approach these more non-perturbative aspects of the theory. Now, if you do consider the perturbations of a prime, those transformations, all the transformations, they do receive corrections. But people like Meissner in 97, they realized that you can also redefine the fields such that their form, at least in the first order of a prime, keep everything as it was. So the theory can be, you can reparameterize your fields, even if you include first order correction of a prime, so that at the end you recover the initial theory that you had. And so now 22 years later, you see there's a big gap here in this history. Olaf Holm and Barton Zilbach, they realized that actually if you assume that you can always do that for every ordering of a prime, that would allow you to classify all possible ODD invariant of prime corrections. And this is an assumption, but this is true in when you consider the full string field theory. And so they assume that what can be done in that framework would actually also be realized in the perturbative structure in string theory.
Yeah, Lee? Sorry, please, question by
you. Yeah, just some quick definition. So D is 4 in this?
No, not yet. Not for now. Depending if you're doing critical or not string theory, but D for the time being is going to be general. Later on, I'm going to specialize.
Okay, so D is not the dimension of space-time.
D is the dimension of spatial dimensions. So we still have time here. So what they called cosmological ansatz means that all the field content depend only on time direction.
Okay. So what does that mean that all the field content depends only on the time direction?
I'm sorry?
What does that mean? That the field content can vary in time but not in space?
Well, in this case, it only means that you're tackling the cosmological background. Of course, this is not the full picture at all. And so all these symmetries that we're going to be discussing here, they can only be imposed at the background level. I'm going to comment a little bit about this when I briefly mentioned about perturbations more towards the end. Okay. But it's good that you already point this out, because to some extent, this is the main limitation of this framework so far. Everything that I'm going to be discussing here is strictly valid for cosmological backgrounds, and it's unclear to which extent that can be expanded when you include perturbations.
So by a cosmological background, you mean a spatially homogeneous solution?
Exactly.
And now you hypothesize that there are spatially homogeneous solutions which have 033 symmetry.
No, they still haven't. I'm going to be discussing later about the solutions, but pretty much everything that we're going to be doing here in this talk is going to be at the background level. And by that, I mean only temporal dependence for the fields. So that's going to be the analog of just solving freedom equations in GR.
Yes, but the slices of homogeneity are going to have a 3-3 metric on in the simplest case.
It's going to have what? I'm sorry?
Freeman, Robinson, Walker has slices of homogeneity which have a three-dimensional metric, a fixed curvature. Now you're having a 3-3 metric.
Right. So I'm going to have only D. So the D here, I only have D. I'm not doing anything like double field theory, for instance. This ODD is not imposed at the level of my space. This ODD, I'm going to show actually later, maybe in one or three slides. So perhaps
you're assuming my questions are smarter than they are. D would normally refer to three dimensions of space, mm-hmm. and a Freeman-Robinson-Walker cosmology has a three-dimensional metric of constant curvature. Mm-hmm. Now you're saying you're doing the same thing. With a slice of constant curvature, the spatial mm-hmm. slice of constant curvature of homogeneity, mm-hmm. which are homogeneous, have an ODD invariant metric on it.
So my metric is not ODD invariant. So this, let me check. I think it's in three slides, perhaps I'm going to clarify what I mean by ODD then. Maybe we can wait until then and see if it's a bit more understandable. But just to conclude with this story so far is that, so this is a story from the early 90s until 2019. And here, this was done in vacuum. So part of our objective is going to be how we can construct or this full alpha prime corrected, which is manifestly ODD formulation string cosmology, but also in the presence of matter. Because of course we want to do cosmology with matter content. And then once we do that, how we can use that perhaps to build a non-singular viral universe model, which would include all those stringy corrections. Okay, so let's now see what I'm talking about. And to start slowly, let's only look to the lowest order vacuum action initially. So what happens is that, as I mentioned, you start with the bosonic sector of string theory, the Maslow's bosonic sector. So we have the metric field, and you have the dilaton, and you have a two form. And so this is the action that you have if there is no other matter content. And what happens is that if you impose a cosmological background, and here I'm being explicit about that, so you see that all the field content it's going to depend only on time, and you have, I'm ignoring the off-diagonal terms. You can always take a foliation in which that's possible. And when you do that and you rewrite the initial action using this particular ansatz, this is the action that you get. Note here that now I change from the normal dilaton, this is small phi, to a capital phi, which is defined in terms of the old dilaton and of the matrix determinant. Now we have also introduced this time covariant derivative, and we introduced this matrix S, which is going to be accounting for both the metric and of the B field. So this action is manifestly invariant under this global ODD and time reprimatization. Now let's see what this ODD is about. So this S matrix now is actually not D by D, but actually is 2D by 2D. And it can be written like this. So now small b and g, these are only the spatial components of the two form that we had initially and of the metric. We have this eta, which is this ODD metric. And we have this curly h. Those are the two objects that compose this matrix S. This curly h sometimes is also called generalized metric, especially in the context of double field theory. So now we see what I meant by ODD. I mean that both this S matrix or eta or this curly h, they are part of the ODD group. And so the rotations that I'm talking about, they are not spatial rotations. They are rotations among the fields. So I can basically rotate between B and G. And I can also rotate the shifted dilaton, this capital phi, which is a scalar under this ODD. So when I went to do ODD rotations, I'm mixing up my field content that I had originally. And this is the ODD symmetry that we have. So with this action, we can now write the equation of motion. And they are given by those three equations that we have here. The first one, when you vary the action relation to the shifted dilaton. Second one with this S metric. And then in relation to the lapse, this is a constraint equation. So this is the lowest order theory in vacuum. Okay, so there is no matter and there are no off-prime corrections here. Now we can, of course, introduce matter in this framework. And this is what people did in the early 90s. This is what also gave rise to pre-Big Bang cosmology and even the equations that people considered to deal with string gas cosmology back in the day. So what you do now, you have the same action that we had before, but you can also introduce some matter action. Ideally, this matter action should also be ODD invariant. And this is in fact true if you have a gas of closed strings. This was actually the feature that was exploited by Buff and Brandenberger in the late 80s. In particular, you can also write something very general for this object. You can also make it dependent on the shifted dilaton if you want. So for now, we keep this as general as possible. And then if you compute the curvature of motion, now we can also define some notion of total energy, which is going to be the variation of this action in relation to the lapse. You have some sort of generalized ODD stress tensor, which is written right here, this curly T. And then you also have, in principle, a sort of like dilatonic charge if you have your matter action depending on the shifted dilaton, which we call sigma here. This is going to be set to zero pretty much throughout the talk, but you can also actually explore this particular feature of the equations. Okay, so we have the equations of motion here. They still lead to a continuity equation. This continuity equation, if you expand in the normal variables, so if you open this S and have the metric in the B field and the shifted dilaton is expanded in terms of the dilaton in the metric, you can actually recover a limit in which you just have the normal continuity equation that you have in GR. This is another way of saying that by doing that, we haven't, of course, spoiled the Bianchi identities associated with the metric. Anyhow, so those are the equations that define this ODD covariant string cosmology in lowest order in alpha prime. And they are the ones that reduce the pre-Big Bang equations once you're evaluating components of these ODD tensors. Lee?
Yes, so... So there is an SO3 symmetry, which is the usual symmetry of space as a global symmetry. And the statement is that that extends to an SO3-3 symmetry, which mixes the metric of space, the components of the metric of space with other fields.
Yeah.
That's the statement.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome. Okay. So Of course, our whole point here is to be able to solve those equations for increasing matter content if we aim at modeling the early universe. So now let's put those equations aside and let's review a little bit what kind of like matter content we can add here to the right side of the equations. So we do a quick intermission and let's just review a little bit what we knew about string cosmology. So in string cosmology, if you take now FRW ansatz plus a perfect fluid, you see that I call FRW ansatz now also setting the B field equals to zero. So those are the typical pre-Big Bang cosmological equations of motion. And you have here some energy and some pressure. Turns out that these equations are invariant under the scale factor duality, which we had mentioned before. You see that we have collapsed the whole ODD group to this only discrete part of the group that has this scale factor going to its inverse. In order to have the full ODD rotation, you need to have the B field actually turned on, because we saw that both the metric and the B field were elements of this S matrix that's part of the ODD group. Now we want to see, to build up some intuition of what happens when we put some string matter here as energy density and pressure. So what do? We can actually look to string gas cosmology. So that's what Brandenburg and Waffa did in 89. And so what they did, they consider a thermodynamical gas of closed strings. And because we know how to compute the string spectrum, we can write the energy density in terms of the states of the string. And this N here is the density of states. To keep things very simple, you can only imagine those closed strings wrapping around only one particular dimension, spatial dimension. If you do that, then you not only have the typical momentum modes, which are going to be discretized, as whenever you have radiation in a box, for instance, but also you're going to have now some contribution called winding. This winding contribution means that you have some sort of states called winding states that are related with the strings wrapping themselves around this compact dimension. And you can also have oscillations propagating across the string, both right and left oscillations. So this is the full energy spectrum that you have associated with the string. And this spectrum is actually invariant. So if you take the scale factor or the radius of this box to its inverse, but you also switch what's called momentum and winding modes, this remains the same. And you can also, of course, compute the pressure once you know the energy density. The problem with this is that, in general, this is very complicated. People don't really know how to compute the density of states for arbitrarily radius of the box. So what we do instead, we model this by taking three different possible matter sectors, only having oscillatory modes, only having momentum modes, and only having winding modes. Because then we can compute precisely what's going to be the pressure associated with these particular states. And if you do that, we have three different equations of state. So we have the equation of state minus 1 over d associated with the winding modes, the 1 equals to 0 associated with oscillatory modes, and also associated with all the modes coexisting together with the same distribution across them. And you have the radiation equation of state when you have only momentum modes. And of course, you can now go back and model the evolution across those modes by a phenomenological approach to the equation of state, where you put some sort of like beta parameter that brings you from a winding equation of state all the way to a momentum equation of state, which models basically a box that was very small initially. And so the excited states were winding modes because they were more affordable, all the way to a box that's expanding, and then you only have momentum modes at the end. What I want to call your attention to here is that we have two interesting solutions. So if you have only winding equation of state, your scale factor evolves like this. It is contracting over time. While if you have a radiation equation of state, your scale factor is a typical radiation-like evolution for the scale factor, but the dilaton is constant. It doesn't evolve. And because the dilaton doesn't evolve, it means that both the string and the Einstein frame are the same. So basically you have a radiation-like evolution on both frames due to the fact that the dilaton is not evolving. I'm showing this because we're going to undermine this later. Those are the solutions to the equations in the lowest order theory, right? And we want to do better than that. So let's start talking about that. Let's include off-prime corrections. So how am I doing on time, by the way? Because we are having questions during the talk. So does that mean that I have a full hour, or
Okay. Yes, you can have more time, of course. There are more questions, but since I interrupted you, so I also have one question. So yeah. Once you fix the number of dimensions, it means that you can only have a particular type of fluid. So say that I fix the number of spatial dimensions to be free, then mm-hmm. I'm able to have radiation, but I'm not able to have a cosmological constant like Poisson state.
Of course, you can imagine that you can combine the different sort of like modes that you have, right? Mm-hmm. But you're right that, if, for instance, if the dimension was three, the sort of like modes that I have here, they allow you to go from -1/3 all the way to 1/3. So mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to use these particular modes of the string to have a Kirchhoff state, which is associated with a cosmological constant, for instance. To that extent, you're correct. But that doesn't mean that you fix the Kirchhoff state. You only fix the, by fixing the dimension, you fix the range.
If I want a standard range, so the one that includes matter, cosmological constant, and the radiation, I would need the one spatial dimension.
Yeah.
So one plus one.
Exactly, which of course wouldn't make much sense. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
But of course, it's a very good question because it's going to be a nice cue for later, because we're going to be trying to recover the Sitter solutions without having a cosmological constant like a Kirchhoff state. Okay, so let's now start including off-prime corrections. So this is basically the work by Olaf Ohm and Bartel Zielbach. So we go back to the lowest order action that we had initially here. And what they were able to show is that if you are considering if you can use actually field redefinitions of order alpha prime to the power k, and if you do that, the kind of like corrections that the action, the lowest order action receive, they are parameterized by this sort of like action for each order in alpha prime. And the important feature of this action is that it is fully dependent on this function x, which has only as a variable this S metric that we saw before, actually the derivative of it. And this is quite astonishing because this is going to be first order, and it has a first order and linear dependence on S. It's not something completely arbitrary that could depend also on the dilaton and other higher order derivatives. And in order to show that, basically they assume induction. They assume that this is the case for the K minus 1th order. And then you can use field redefinitions that shift your fields in this particular fashion. And then when you do that, you can also consider lapse redefinitions. And by considering both lapse redefinitions and field redefinitions in that particular form, you can actually show that your corrected action, order by order in alpha prime, has to take this particular form. And so this is a large simplification over what could have been, perhaps, because you are, of course, coming from a higher derivative sort of corrections to each alpha prime. You have actually higher derivatives associated with those corrections. But by integration by parts and field redefinitions, such that the one that I showed before, you constrain the action to have this particular form. And this action is quite impressive in the sense that you don't have any dilaton contribution besides the one that you had before in this particular ODD volume form here, and the typical kinetic term for the dilaton. And you also don't have extra time derivatives of the S metric. So this is what's impressive about this. Lee?
Yes, two things. So before this alpha prime corrections, what you would have meant when you said that this theory was related to string theory was only that it had winding modes. I think that's correct. But everything that's in the theory that doesn't derive from string theory, that derives from string theory, is the fact that there are winding modes. Now you're saying there are much more stringent consequences of being derived from string theory, which is these alpha prime corrections. Is that the right way to look at it?
I'm not sure if I got the full picture,
If this effective theory is right, mm-hmm. If you only went up to the last page, you would have that you had discovered winding modes. And then you would say that's a property of some string theories. But now you have much more constraints.
Yeah.
You have these particular forms for the alpha prime.
Correct. Exactly. Yes. Aloha, did you have
a question? In a sense, winding modes are a re-expression of a t-duality, right?
Yes. I don't quite understand the emphasis on winding modes for this particular part.
I think maybe I can illustrate that. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, Yemi. I think there's really two consequences of string theory, right? One is the fact that not only there's the massless sectors as a metric, but it also has a dilaton and a B field. And then these guys, they can be reabsorbed into this ODD singlet or multiplet. So that's string theory, even if there's no winding mode. I think this is where string theory differ from other theory, because other theory don't have to have a dilaton or these things, and they don't have to repackage this data in that particular way, mm-hmm. right? So then, as you're saying, Lee, there's also the dilaton, which is important, but I think the first step is important to you, and that's also the first step you're using, if I understand correctly, Yemi, to kind of constraints, the fact that it's not an arbitrary metric description that comes, but it's always, bundled up in that particular form, which is very important. Is that right?
Absolutely.
But the presence of a dilaton is your poisoned apple, because as long as there's a dilaton, there's no nice stable solutions with constant radius.
Yeah, so
you always have a dilaton.
The dilaton is the prediction of string theory. That's something that at least Guillaume is not shying away. It's right. A very robust prediction. Yes.
Right, and it's a disaster.
Yeah,
I don't know. Let's see what he does with it. Right? It's there. It has to be taken into account. Of course, if you ignore it, I think you're not dealing with string theory.
Absolutely. But I think it's good to point that out from now. And you're going to see that when we do go and talk about the model, we're going to be a bit sneaky about what to do with the dilaton. But because it is, in fact, an issue, as Lee is pointing out. Okay, I have more or less, I guess, 14 minutes or so. So I'm going to try to keep going.
There is a typo in this question, right? It's E2 minus phi.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. No problem.
Thank you for that. So, yes, we are here. We now have, in principle, shown that, or I'm telling you that the corrections take this particular form, which is very simplified from everything else that could have been. But there is a drawback, and you see that all those this infinite sum here, each term has a particular coefficient that we don't know what it is. So this would be, if we knew how to do the full perturbative string expansion in terms of the alpha prime parameter, then in principle we would be able to calculate the C case, which would parameterize each of those corrections to the action. But in fact, we know only C1 and C2, basically. I think there is a calculation for C3, but not for C4. So basically, to calculate those coefficients, is basically you'd have to compute the beta functions for the metric, for the B field, and the dilaton ordered by order in alpha prime. And of course, this is a very complicated enterprise. What is surprising is that we're going to be able to, nonetheless, do things with this action. And so let's look to what happens. So here we are still in the vacuum context. So we have the vacuum alpha prime corrected string cosmology. And then you can pose now this FRW ansatz as we did before. And you actually have a nice looking sort of Friedemann-like equations that are written here, where we have introduced this function f of h is a Hubble parameter, which encapsulates all the possible corrections that we had before in our action. So these would be the equations. Those are the equations that Holm and Zielbach were using in their paper to find some solutions to them and what are the possibilities coming from string theory. Now, our task here is how can we actually include matter in such a framework? And the question that we had when we wrote the first paper was, should we first add matter to the lowest order and then repeat the whole procedure as Barton and Olaf did? Or you can just take matter and add to already the corrected action. And part of the paper was showing that both procedures are equivalent. So because they're equivalent, at the end of the day, you can simply come, take the same action that they had before and just introduce matter directly. Because the matter fields also are going to allow for field redefinitions, and then you can repeat this, the whole process that they did, this induction to classify all possible corrections. And then if you do that, at the end of the day, those are the set of equations that we have. So we have the equation that we just saw before, now coupled with matter. And because correcting the equation with alpha prime corrections, that has nothing to do with spoiling the field morphology invariance, we still have the Bianchi identities, and then you can derive the continuity equation as expected. Okay, so we end here. This is like the end part of the formalism or the set of equations we're going to be using. Now we're going to try to exploit that to find interesting solutions. Is there any other question at this time? Okay, so let's keep going. Now we want to do some FRW alpha prime cosmology using those equations. So for this talk, we're going to kill again the B field. So we don't have the B field anymore. We have, therefore, only the Hubble parameter showing here together with the shifted dilaton. And we have the matter sector, as you see here. We're going to be pretty much ignoring the possible dilatonic charge, as I mentioned before. This set of equations is invariant under scale factor duality. So the full corrected theory still preserves the scale factor duality as expected. And this is just the remnant of the full transformation that we had before that were allowed for this cosmological background. Let's look to solutions. So as one of the concerns is a dilaton, let's see if there are only any viable solutions which have a constant dilaton. And we know like the dilaton, the rolling dilaton can be a problem with the equivalence principle, for instance. So we need to be able to stabilize it. But before we even talk about that, let's just see if once I have a stabilized dilaton, what kind of solution I can have for my cosmology. And in fact, if you impose a constant dilaton in those equations, you arrive at those two conditions we have here. And then you have a systematic way of generating solutions because those two equations, they are parameterized by the equation of state, which means now that you can write things down perturbatively. So if you take this f of h function that we saw before that has all the alpha prime corrections in the right order by order, you can now plug that back into those equations and try to solve it. So the first condition actually leads to this equation, which is algebraic, because now we are matching each term in alpha prime on that equation and putting them to zero. And you see that if you ignore the second line, you have only the first line. You see that the only possible solution for the matter sector would be the equation of state W equals 1 over D. Now, remember before I showed constant dilaton implied a radiation equation of state. So we recover this here, as you can see in the lowest order part of this equation. But of course, the W equals 1 over D solution is not a solution to now this the first correction that you have to that equation. And in fact, you can show that there is not anymore any constant equation of state, which would be a perturbative solution to those equations. So remember before, without any alpha prime correction, a constant dilaton implied a radiation equation of state. Now a constant dilaton, you cannot actually have a constant equation of state, but nonetheless, you can solve this equation perturbatively, term by term. And so by imposing a constant dilaton, you still recover a unique time-dependent equation of state, which is completely fixed by the coefficients, C2, C3, or CK that we had before, and also by the Hubble parameter. And then you have those coefficients here, W2, W3, they are all, they can be calculated as well. Okay, now let's talk about the sitter, which is also, I guess it's redundant to say these days why it's important to have anything that looks like the sitter. It's relevant both for early and nighttime cosmology. So let's go back to the equations. Let's impose H to be constant. When you do that, you arrive at those three different conditions, those two conditions here, and this particular evolution equation for the shifted dilaton. And then if you further impose that you have a constant equation of state, so we are looking now at scenarios where you have the sitter being given by a constant equation of state, you have two possibilities for the shifted dilaton. It can be either constant or evolving this particular way down here. So let's look at each case. So the first one, if the shifted dilaton is constant, you can either have a vacuum solution or you can be in a pressureless matter state, which possibly can be used to model the Hagedorn phase. We're going to actually rely a little bit on that for the model. But of course, if you have a constant shifted dilaton, you do have a running dilaton. So that's not ideal if you would like to use these sort of solutions to model, for instance, dark energy. And moreover, the H naught value would be expected to be defined by the string scale. So of course, that's completely not tangible if you would like to use these to talk about our current phase of accelerated expansion. Second possibility is that you have the shifted dilaton evolving in this particular fashion. Now you can implement that through any equation of state, but then you have a running dilaton which runs like this. And this is going to be important in a second, but before that, this is also interesting because you can, for this particular case, have a Hubble parameter which is parameterized by an initial condition on the energy density. So in principle, it's not set by the string scale. So it's a bit more interesting phenomenologically speaking. And maybe more importantly is that you can see here that there is a particular solution where the dilaton is also constant. And this is exactly when you have a equation of state, which is of a cosmological constant. So if you forget the string cosmology part of the talk where we only talk about winding, oscillatory, and momentum modes, if you allow for any sort of matter, what we're showing here is that it's possible to have a de Sitter evolution for an equation of state given by a cosmological constant with a dilaton being a constant. Therefore, you have the same for Einstein frame and Jordan frame. And this is being achieved by having all possible corrections and alpha prime corrections. So this is a non-perturbative solution of the theory, which is kind of interesting. Of course, at the end of the day, we're interested in the Einstein frame. So we can actually compute what's the Hubble-like evolution in the Einstein frame and also its derivative. You can actually write down everything in terms of the Jordan frame variable. So everything that has the subscript E here is in the Einstein frame, otherwise it's in the string frame. And what we immediately see is that if the shifted dilaton, this first equation, equals to minus H naught, assuming that you have a de Sitter phase in the string frame, then your Hubble parameter in the Einstein frame equals to zero. So now what we achieved is that what we realized that there are de Sitter solutions in string frame, which correspond to a static universe in the Einstein frame. Moreover, when you do that, we just saw that in order to have this kind of solution for the shifted dilaton right here, the evolution of the shifted dilaton is given by the equation of state in such a form. And this is going to only be possible if you have a winding equation state. So this is what gave pretty much rise to the model that we later on introduced. Remember before, at the lowest order theory with a winding equation of state, we had the contraction in the sitter, in the string frame for all the directions. Now what we are seeing is the following. If you have a winding equation of state, not only you have the sitter happening in the string frame, but that also leads into a static universe in the Einstein frame. And if you remember when we talked about alternatives to inflation, that was exactly what we needed. We needed a static background in Einstein frame with the holographic scaling so that we could recover a power spectrum, which was almost a scale invariant. Note that in the paper by Vandenberg and Waffe, when they proposed the string gas cosmological scenario, they postulated that you had this static phase in Einstein frame, but they didn't have equations that gave as a solution this static phase. So it's within the framework where you include all possible off-run corrections and having a winding equation state that you do achieve this phase in the Einstein frame. And so this is what led us to develop this model, which is, as I call here, a rose-tinted model, because of course there are many different assumptions and there are things, there's a lot of room for improvement. In particular, to develop the model first, we needed to extend the framework that we just discussed to also talk about anisotropic cosmological backgrounds, because you have to divide now the sector. If you want to talk about critical strings that don't live, of course, in 4D, then you need to have two sectors. You're going to have like the three-dimensional spatial sector that is going to expand and becomes enlarged. And you're going to have this six-dimensional internal sector of the theory that has to be contained and cannot expand to become our universe. Moreover, in order to create this model, we cannot treat the equation of state continuously because we have this difficulty that we don't know how to write down the density of state. So we have to parameterize in terms of winding, oscillatory, and then momentum modes. But once you do that, what you have to do is just starting with a de Sitter solution in string frame for 10 dimensions, 10 space-time dimensions, so both time and space. And you have a winding equation state. So you just assume that you have a very small box, basically, so that you only have winding modes. That's going to lead you into having this static phase in the Einstein frame that we needed. And that's the starting point. And this is the final result. Of course, I'm not showing any of the calculations, but this is the summary of the model. I'm going to describe a little bit what's going on here. You are more than welcome to check our paper about the model to see how we model each of those different phases. But they are all, yeah, they are all modeled based on the equation of state that you have here on the left. And we show how to glue those different phases, both in string frame and in the Einstein frame. So what do we have here? In the left-hand side, we have the equation state. So you see that the equation state has two different behaviors for the internal and external directions. Internal directions is the sector that's going to remain compact. So those are the hidden dimensions. It's going to be six-dimensional, this internal space. And the equation state starts as -1/9, and approaches zero asymptotically. Why? Well, this is also based on the fact that winding modes can only annihilate for three spatial directions, while for the other directions, they basically cannot find themselves in this space so that they can annihilate and produce radiation. And while you have winding modes coexisting with oscillatory modes and momentum modes, the average equation state is going to be zero. And so this is what justifies the evolution of equation state for the internal sector like that. Well, for the external directions, we start also with -1/9, but then you evolve all the way to 1/3, because the external directions is only three-dimensional. And here the winding modes can find themselves and they can annihilate and produce a lot of like momentum modes. And then as the box keeps expanding, you only have more and more momentum modes, and they all account for a radiation equation state. So understanding now the sort of matter sector, which is fully parameterized by the equation state, we can then look to the string frame and Einstein frame for each sector. Of course, the initial phase for the internal and external sector is going to be the same. So you can note that this part here and this part here, they look absolutely the same. So let's just describe the first one. What's happening in string frame, as we said before, we have a de Sitter phase. So the scale factor is evolving exponentially. The Hubble parameter is constant, as it's here. So the Hubble radius is also constant. While in the Einstein frame, we have a static phase, as we mentioned. So you see that the scale factor here remains constant, while the Hubble radius is infinity. That's why it's shown only up here. Now, after the transition from the winding evolution to the evolution with zero pressure, what happens is that in the string frame, the scale factor ends up stabilizing and becoming a constant. And therefore, the Hubble radius goes to infinity. While in the Einstein frame, and here is the point about the dilaton, at some point, the dilaton stabilizes. And I'm going to give a word about that soon. But once that happens, then the evolution of the string frame and Einstein frame, they become the same. And so you have the same behavior here. That's why the Hubble radius also goes to infinity. And the scale factor is static. So for the model, in the end, the internal sector becomes completely stabilized to the extent that the equation state goes to zero. Of course, this going to zero is an average behavior. So this is not exactly constant. So this is the same for the external sector as we just described for the internal sector. So let's look to the phase after the transition. So after the transition, the equation state approaches radiation. So in the string frame, you just have a sort of like standard cosmological evolution. And in the Einstein frame, we do have the picture that you maybe remember when we talked about alternatives to inflation at the beginning. So you see the Hubble radius starting off as infinity, decaying, and then growing again linearly with time, and the scale factor finally evolving as standard cosmological expansion, depending on the matter content. Here, of course, radiation. What's really interesting here is that maybe you, if you remember the picture I showed before, coming from string gas cosmology, initially, when they would talk about this initial phase for the scale factor, they wouldn't have this particular part of the curve that we have here in our model. This wouldn't be present because we do have this particular part of the curve here for the scale factor. As you can see, what's happening is that the Hubble radius is decaying. If the Hubble radius is decaying, it means that the Hubble parameter is growing over time. So not only you have an inflationary phase in this short period of time, you have a super inflationary phase because H dot is positive. And in fact, in the latest paper that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, we show that with only a single Hubble time under this particular evolution here, you can actually explain the horizon and the flattens problem in this model. So different than inflation, you don't need to have 60 E-folds in order to explain away those issues at the background level. With a single Hubble time, you can do that. The thing about the dilaton, so as I promised, just a small word, the dilaton throughout this whole dynamics here is always evolving linearly. So it's growing over time. And of course, when the dilaton is around one, then you reach this strong coupled regime of the theory, where the whole perturbative theory has to be basically thrown away and you need to have some sort of non-perturbative corrections. And so what we propose is that we have to tune the initial value of the dilaton so that by T star here, the dilaton approach more or less a value one. And then you expect that some quantum corrections to the dilaton in terms of a potential would allow the dilaton to stabilize. This is usually what people like Lamour, I guess, and Podolsky had considered in the past. So in the paper, we just comment on that this would be the perhaps a natural mechanism to stabilize the dilaton here. But of course, this is something that we should be aware of. Anyway, so this was the summary of the cosmological model. So we saw that we start in the beginning from just pure formalism all the way now to having a sort of like cosmological model that at least the background level can be an alternative to inflation and also is non-singular. So, but of course, there's a lot of information. So if in a few years we meet, maybe a few things that you can keep in mind is that we discussed equations here in the context of string cosmology that are non-perturbative in the string length expansion, in the alpha prime expansion. Nonetheless, those equations are classical, so we never considered any sort of like loop corrections. And they are quite handy, even though they depend on an infinite number of unknown coefficients, but they are handy in the way that they're useful to show that mostly likely all the perturbative results sort of break down. And we saw two solutions at the perturbative level that are not valid anymore. And also we didn't find any particular obstructions to consider more controversial solutions such as the sitter or even this emergent scenario that we just used for the model. And finally, that framework allowed us to have many different cosmological solutions, including the construction of this model that at the end has like four large dimensions and could be an alternative to inflation. Of course, there's a lot of work. And the good thing about talking, as you can see, I have revamped the talk that I gave actually more or less a year ago, because since then, some of the points that I was proposing at the end of the talk, we have more or less tackled. So you can do other things. You can build other sort of realistic cosmological scenarios. For instance, like thinking about bouncing. This was achieved last year. You can also suit energy conditions and just non-singular solutions more generally. We also have approached that problem in this particular paper. And finally, you can also turn on the B field and allow the full ODD symmetry. So you sort of like allow matter with viscosity. And this was also worked out partially in this paper right here. There is more to be done. One can think about model compactification scheme, or even the cosmological perturbations, which hasn't really been tackled. In this paper, we more or less start the discussion around this topic, but it has to be improved. So that's more or less it. Thank you very much for all the questions and for invitation again.
Thank you, Yem, for the nice talk. Okay, are there questions? First from students. I don't see questions from students yet, but there is a question by Zana.
Yes, okay. Thank you for this nice talk. So just first a question for clarification. So do you have a contracting phase in these models?
It depends in which frame you're talking about. But yes, there is a small contracting phase that you can see right here, for instance. So this is the internal sector in the Einstein frame when there's a transition. So yeah, this is the only contracting phase that we have for the model.
Okay, and so in general, would that cause any problems? Like in many of the contracting models with the bounds, you would have instabilities associated with anisotropies or instabilities for the perturbations. Is that an issue for your model?
I think it's a great question, and I unfortunately don't have an answer for that because we haven't really approached perturbations. As Lee was asking at the beginning of the talk, everything that I presented so far, it's strictly valid for a cosmological background. As soon as you want to consider perturbations, things become quite tricky, and we haven't attempted to do that fully. On the other hand, maybe just as a quick comment, my intuition would be that at least for this very short phase here that you have contraction, there wouldn't be an issue. Of course, it's hard to see in this diagram, but this contracting phase is actually very, very short-lived. It only accounts for basically transition of the Kirchhoff state from -1/9 to zero. And so there is nothing that looks like a bounce if that would be the main concern for having instabilities here.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Laurent?
Can you went really fast with the dilatant stabilization. So can you go back to it and, you know, the question of Lee, like the concerns of Lee?
So I, as I mentioned, even in the beginning, I'm a bit sneaky about the dilatant here, right? So we did two things. The first thing that we discussed before was, let's just see what kind of solutions would be available if the dilatant is stabilized and constant. And so we look into that and we saw that we could have even a sitter or having like this static phase. But of course, it's still, we would have to have a proper mechanism to stabilize the dilatant. And we never show that. We just rely on the literature, on the fact that when you approach the strongly coupled regime of the theory, you would expect the dilatant to pick up some quantum potential, basically. And then luckily, or maybe it's a wishful thinking here, but that could allow you to stabilize the dilatant. This is like this paper by, I think, Spodolsky and Lamour a few years, like maybe early 2000s. But as I say, it might be at this stage wishful thinking. I'm not sure if it's clear that we do have a proper mechanism to stabilize the dilatant in string theory in general. Of course, here for us, we have to rely that this will happen somehow. And we associate this stage to the stage where the theory becomes strongly coupled. That's all we say to write down the model. And I reckon that it might be a bit unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Just a question, I mean, it's technical. The fact that, you know, the ODD environment dilatant is shifted, does that play any role compared to the usual picture? Or?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it helps to solve the equations in terms of the shifted dilatant, because things are a bit more compact, compactly written. But not beyond that. Maybe just one thing that just occurred to me, back to your question. One thing that we haven't tried, and perhaps could be also a small interesting project in this framework, would be trying to find solutions for the equation state such that you have the constant dilaton as an attractor. So instead of like relying on some sort of like strongly coupled regime of the theory to stabilize the dilaton, maybe there is some sort of like set of solutions for those equations in which the matter sector conducts you towards a phase in which the dilaton becomes constant. And then actually we haven't looked into that. So maybe it's something for the future.
I also have some questions. So in particular, at some point you started showing solutions with the constant dilaton or constant time derivative of the dilaton, but I did not get exactly where these solutions come from. So which specifically, which specific CK coefficients did you use, right, considering that they are not all known?
That's a good question. So let me reply your question in another context, because then I can show you some equations. So instead of like talking about the whole approach is the same. So let's think about imposing the sitter. We went to the sitter solution. You see that if you impose the sitter, and this happens also if you impose a constant dilaton, you arrive at the conditions for those functions, f of h. You see, for instance, here f of h naught equals to the derivative of f h naught times h naught over 2. So those equations are given constraints over the set of coefficients. But we never really have to, so the solutions that we are getting, to some extent, what is being shown is that there are no obstructions to build those kind of solutions. Now, if you can indeed compute the CKs and show that they satisfy this condition, that's a whole other story that we cannot answer because we don't have the CKs. So in the words of Olaf and Barto in their paper, you can think of this, of the following. What we have built here is the ODD theory framework, basically, that can have all the possible solutions for whatever kind of CKs that you can introduce there. The string theory, in principle, is going to fix only once, like each different type of string theory is going to fix you the CKs. So you won't have access to all the possible CKs that could perhaps give rise to this sort of like constraint here. So it's unclear at this stage if all the solutions that we have built here, they are indeed containing string theory because we don't know what the CKs would correspond to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was confused by your statement that this is what the theory would predict, but I did not get if the CK that you used or the F that you used actually came from the theory.
Exactly. No, yeah. So from that point of view, just to emphasize again, what we are getting here are, what we're finding here, there are no obstructions to build those solutions. But if they do exist or not, we have to wait and see if someone can compute the CKs and then plug back here and see if they satisfy the conditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a good point.
Okay. And also you did not really study singular key resolution here because you only specialized to the sitter-like universe, right? And
what do you mean? Yeah.
One of the points that you mentioned at the beginning is that with the problem with inflation is that it cannot be continued to infinite past. So it is singular. So I was wondering if in this model you can overcome this issue.
Exactly. So here, for instance, in this model, as you can see, for instance, in isoframe, everything is pretty well defined in terms of the curvature. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, looking to the SM frame can be, in this context, misleading because you still have the dilaton. And maybe the question is like, is the dilaton singular?
But you also had the specific solutions for the dilaton, right? The constant one and the growing one.
Exactly. For this model here, all this, those three different phases that you can perhaps understand by this part, and this part, the dilaton is evolving linearly in time. So the dilaton, and if it does stabilize at some point, so it's going to be finite in the future. But of course, if you take t going to minus infinity, then the dilaton would be singular, would be minus infinity at the beginning. But then, yeah, in fact, you're throwing away singularity all the way to t equals minus infinity. So in that sense, we're doing better than just having a singularity, which is at t equals zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the stabilization of the dilator, you meant like in the future, because in principle, that would be a regime where one would like to recover GR. And so still the string loop corrections would be suppressed, and this means that essentially the dilator has to be under control also in that region. But I don't see how at that point any corrections to the theory can stabilize the theory, because at large distances, curvature is low, and therefore the alpha prime tower essentially does not matter. I mean, it is there, but it is suppressed. And the GS corrections are also suppressed.
So there is something that we comment on the paper, but I haven't mentioned here. There is another possibility for stabilizing the dilaton. So if you start with the lowest order equations with the matter sector, mm-hmm. you can actually show that the if you impose a radiation equation of state, then your dilaton becomes a the dilaton being a constant is an attractor. You can actually show that for the lowest order theory. Here, of course, we don't have the lowest order theory. We have off-parameter corrections. But what can happen is that in principle, and then perhaps this would be a sort of tuning of the theory, but what you could do is that you could enter this second phase here already with a box which is a bit larger, and therefore the off-parameter corrections are becoming less and less relevant. And as the box keeps expanding, less and less the corrections are important until you reach the lowest order theory that you had initially. And then you know that because you have an equation of state which is radiation, the dilaton will asymptotically become also a constant. And then I never have to invoke any sort of like strongly coupled regime to explain why the dilaton magically became stabilized. This is a possibility that we only comment on the paper. We show that indeed you have this perturbative sort of solution that you can play with, but we never were very explicit about that. But that would be another possibility of somehow seeing the dilaton dynamically stabilizing without invoking any sort of like magical quantum correction to its potential.
Okay, that's nice. There is another question by Susan. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry, just one last question. Because now I was confused about your answer to Alessia's question, like about the singularity. Mm-hmm. So do you solve the singularity for the scale factor, or how can I imagine the evolution of the scale factor more precisely?
Uh-huh. So if you look here, for instance, like the external directions, right? Basically, the scale factor is initially constant and then it grows. So there is not a point in which the scale factor becomes zero, and therefore the Hubble radius the Hubble parameter becoming divergent. So you don't have any sort of like singularity here. But what I was telling before was that when you have a dilaton or you have other field content in the theory, you shouldn't only anymore be concerned exclusively with curvature singularities. You have to see if all the field content of the theory is well behaved. And then what I was pointing out was that the dilaton actually evolves linearly. And so it is also well behaved because it becomes only infinity all the way to infinity past. There isn't like a finite time in which you reach the singularity of the dilaton field.
Okay, and so you would basically need to choose an initial value for the scale factor then.
Both for the scale factor, but the scale factor is the easy one because you want to start with a winding equation state. What we really have to choose is the initial value for the dilaton more than actually the scale factor.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And we're welcome.
Lee, do you have a question?
Yes, last question. I would think, given that string theory has a vast landscape of solutions or classical versions or whatever, that the right thing to do with the constants that you can't calculate, the CK, is to study a landscape of them.
Mm.
Because
what you're interested in is the properties of the flow on the landscape, such as whether there are attractive and critical points and so forth.
Yeah, it's a good point. I haven't thought through from that angle, because for me the CKs were purely coming from computing the beta functions for the metric, the B field and the dilaton for the word sheet action basically. Mm-hmm. But perhaps thinking about the landscape would actually be more useful.
And do you assume, or is it true, that all these theories are time reversible?
I mean, as far as I know, string theory is time reversible. So I don't think that here what we have done would assume otherwise. In fact, the theory is time, we have time reparameterization as one of the symmetries of the theory.
That doesn't mean it's time reversible.
Well, I mean, I would assume that make the T going to minus T transformation would also be a sort of a time reparameterization.
That's true. Okay.
One more question by Leos.
Ladus, I think. Are you?
Okay, maybe you can hear me now.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. In the diagram that you have, when the dilaton is running at early times in the string frame, mm-hmm. it's just a question of a sign. Is it very early times? Is it a weak coupling or strong coupling?
A weak coupling.
So that's okay. So that's hardly a singularity, is it?
Oh yeah, no, it's not. That was what I was trying to say. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Here throughout most of the evolution here, the dilaton is actually is slightly negative, and then if we want to rely on this mechanism that somehow the dilaton is stabilized by approaching this strong couple regime of the theory, then it approaches the value of one more or less around here. But yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Next, there is a question by Nomrata.
Yes, hi. Thank you for the wonderful talk. I just have a quick question. When you introduced matter in the alpha prime cosmology, do you think that that theory would perhaps predict or, you know, hint at the matter antimatter asymmetry as the time goes on in that theory?
I think that it's an interesting question, and unfortunately, I don't have a good answer to that. Here everything that we model is at a very coarse-grained level, in the sense that at the end of the day, I'm calling everything basically a perfect fluid with only a pressure and energy density. So I barely have any knowledge or access to what would be really happening at the microscopic level. I'm sorry, I'm afraid I can't say much more than that.
Right, but would it be possible to extend the theory? Because like when you look at the CMB and you look at the small, the small fluctuations, perhaps it's possible to extend a theory to see if there was, I don't know, that's all right. I was just wondering if it's even possible at some point in the future.
No, you're asking about parity breaking.
Yes.
Yes, that's a great question. We should be able to address that.
Okay. Would that work with like the forces too? Like, you know, early universe, the way the forces, might have worked, and then breaking into, you know, electromagnetic, weak, strong later on. If we didn't include matter, but like specifically looked at just the bosonic fields.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the way I would approach your question would be to say that, of course, we have all sort of different excitation of the string and the massless excitations, they give rise to the fields that we discussed, the dilaton, the metric, the B field, but then you have other excitations which would give rise to the gauge fields and other forces that you were mentioning. But you see, like what we done here, we pretty much called all of that metric sector and we packed all of that into what we call like a fluid. And so it's a very, very rough way of modeling the whole metric content that you could have available coming from string theory. So I think your question is really good, but unfortunately, given what we've done here, it's far-fetched to me to approach answering those questions. But I think it's good that you're thinking about that because of course, at the end of the day, even if this was a good model to explain what happened in the beginning or at the early universe, you still need to recover what we know to be here, right? Including all the forces and interactions and the normal matter. And you're of course touching on a point that is a struggle and has been a struggle in string theory for many, many years, which is only even recover the standard model that we have. It's not clear that we can do that in a robust way.
Right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.